My name's Kester Brewer, and I'm part of the talks committee who invite various people to speak at Greenbelt, so you can lynch me afterwards. But it's my enormous pleasure to welcome Fran Abrahams to Greenbelt. I read an article by Fran in a magazine I subscribe to called Prospect, which put me onto her work again, and I felt that this was someone who we really ought to invite to Greenbelt, someone who is in touch with people, as I might say. David Cameron talks about hugging a hoodie or loving the hoodie, and I think perhaps what he may mean by that is if that you get close to people and begin to try and to understand them, actually those boundaries that we put up between us and them and create this fear culture around them perhaps begin to disintegrate. And Fran has been doing this in various ways with a previous book she wrote called Below the Breadline, which was all about living on the minimum wage and actually experiencing that for herself, meeting those people, living in that way. And in her latest book called Seven Kings, which is not even out yet, but we've raided their warehouse and got some copies in the bookshop, which is about how to be a teenager and her experience of actually connected with teenagers. So it's fantastic to have Fran here, and let's give her a very big warm welcome.
Well, hello, and thank you all very much for coming. I'm really impressed with this turnout. So I hope, can you all hear me all right? That's the first thing. You can hear what I'm saying. That's great. I should probably just start by introducing myself a little bit. Kester, as you heard, told you he'd read an article by me. I'm basically by trade a journalist. And for about 10 years of my life, I worked as an education correspondent, which meant on a range of national papers, including The Independent, for several years. And I suppose it occurred to me, after having done things like looking at life on the minimum wage, what I'd never done, really, was to look at life in a school. And, you know, though I'd spent 10 years going in and out of schools every week of my life, I'd never spent more than about 2 hours in any single school, nor had I ever really got to know what it felt like to be a pupil in a school, what it felt like to be a young person, and what, you know, what the day-to-day life of a single school would be like. And so I sort of set out on this journey to try and find a place somewhere that would be willing to have me for a year, or in and out for a year anyway, and to find a group of young people within that school who I could then follow through their daily lives. And as it grew, I decided to follow them not just within school, but in their home lives as well. Particularly because I think, you know, I sort of felt that if I was really going to understand what teenagers were about, I would need to understand a lot more than what they did at school. I thought parents might be quite interested to know what their young people did at school all day. I thought that actually, of course, what they do at home and what they learn at home is so incredibly important to their view of the world and what they become. So that's how it came about. And eventually found a school. I started out thinking that I'd go somewhere sort of gritty and urban, you know, cutting edge, somewhere where people were sort of living perhaps quite difficult existences. And that wasn't really how it worked out. I ended up in Ilford, which is by no means, I don't know if anyone here from Ilford at all? No. But it's certainly by no means a kind of leafy or middle class area, very much the opposite. But it's, well, I'll tell you a bit more about it in a little while, but it's just an extraordinary place. But I thought, first of all, I'd start out by reading you a sort of typical, what I think of as a sort of typical view of teenagers. I'm going to read you a few extracts from the book as well. But this is actually from a column by Melanie Phillips in the Daily Mail. The headline is "The Antisocial Champions of the World." And it's pretty much what you'd expect, I suppose. She reports, "British teenagers are the worst in Europe when it comes to binge drinking, drunkenness and drug use." She says Britain boasts the highest pregnancy rate in Europe among under-18s, the highest number of abortions, and the number of sexually transmitted infections is soaring, and so it goes on. And she concludes, when all this is put together, it amounts to a horrifying litany of social, moral and intellectual disintegration among Britain's youth. Its teenagers seem to have become a lost generation. With all constraints and boundaries being progressively kicked away, their behaviours descended into a free-for-all. And I notice there's probably quite a few of you here may even be teenagers. I'm sure you are, and I don't know. You probably recognise the description even if you don't accept it. I hope you don't accept it. Maybe you do. Anyway, I'll give you a chance to come back in a little while if you have anything to say about that. But I suppose that's where I started. And, of course, going into a school, that's where they thought I was starting. It's not, I have to sort of say I didn't think that, but, of course, any school letting a writer in would be wondering whether that was what was going to come out, even even though this particular school knew very well that it wasn't, or it shouldn't. But I have to say, what I saw at Seven Kings High School in Ilford was absolutely, it could not have been further from the picture that you see, you know, that column by Melanie Phillips represents. As I say, Ilford's, you know, it's not by no means a leafy middle class area, but it's not either the kind of inner city, you know, deprived sort of place either. It's very much one of the, I don't know if many people know, sort of outer London boroughs. It's one of those places that, what's special about it to me, I think, is that it's full of people who've probably always been on the move. It's not the place where people go when they first arrive in this country as immigrants. It's the place they move on to. And so over the years, and then they move on again. So over the years, there's been a big Jewish community there, a Polish community, an Irish community, and now the vast majority of children at Seven Kings High School, about 80%, come from the Indian subcontinent, from Pakistan or India. Well, they don't come from there, sorry. Their parents or grandparents would have come from there and very likely would have moved to Ilford after living in Newham or one of the inner city boroughs. So it's very much a place that's on the move. It's a place with a kind of ambition and a kind of drive about it, which I found, you know, incredibly moving, really. But in many, many ways, Seven Kings is just an ordinary school. It's a comprehensive school. It's been a comprehensive school for about 30 years. It's mixed. It has 11 to 18 pupils, and it's about 1,300, which is big. And you would say it's a very ordinary intake. If you look at the SAT results of pupils from the primary schools coming in, very much, very close to the national average. You know, free school meals levels, which is an indicator of levels of poverty, probably a bit higher than the average, but not, you know, not the highest by any means. And you would think, you know, perhaps this is going to be a very, very ordinary group of teenagers. And certainly the headmaster, one of his sort of comments to me at a very early stage was, are people really going to want to know about this? He said, these are just really ordinary kids, you know. And I'd say I'm really pleased that there's lots of people here, because I did wonder that myself. But once I got to know them, I completely changed my view. And, you know, we had that sort of conversation again, and I just turned around and said, no, they're not ordinary, they're extraordinary. They really are. They were fantastic, every single one of them. But what was really striking about them was that they were fantastic in their ordinariness and in their kind of commitment to their lives and their sense of drive. They were just an inspiration, really. And I thought I would just tell you about, I mean, I'll tell you about a few of them, but I'll start by telling you about one of them, Perrin, who was 18, just about to take his A-levels. And Perrin uses a wheelchair, but he doesn't, you know, see that as a bar to anything in his life, really. He just gets on and does it. And he's a very, very bright, very ambitious, very driven boy from a family whose, well, his father came to England as a Ugandan Asian refugee in the 70s. And from, as I say, arriving in Newham with nothing, his father qualified as a pharmacist. The family now have a very successful business. Perrin's cousins are training to be doctors and lawyers and, you know, fantastic sort of story of, you know, a family who've moved on. And it's not a unique story in that area by any means, but a family who've achieved an enormous amount in quite a short time. And I suppose that's something you'd need to know about Perrin, that, you know, he sees himself very much as someone who would be in business, would be an entrepreneur, is interested in money and finance, thinking about going to university to study economics. And when I asked him, you know, where do you think you're going to be in 10 years' time, this is what he, what his response was. Perrin hopes that wherever he is, he'll be making good money. Maybe, he thinks, he'll be living in a big mansion somewhere outside London, a country estate even, with a big garage for all his cars. And how will he live in this big house? Will he be alone? He hopes not. He likes to think that he'll be married with children, maybe. He wants to have a decent family, live a decent life and be totally himself. Then he'll be happy. But that'll depend on finding the right person, of course, he says quickly. Which I think is kind of, I suppose, interesting. I mean, you know, so he's someone who's quite focused on sort of, you know, doing well financially and so on, but also really focused on his family. I mean, that's one thing I think is not something people think about young people. They think about dissent, they think about bad relationships with adults. That was not the case with most of the kids or young people that I was following around. They had really good relationships with their parents, and they saw themselves very much as part of a family unit, and they had their, you know, their kind of vision of their own future, if you like, was of being part of a nuclear family, being part of, you know, sort of a wider family as well. And, you know, that was something that was incredibly important to all of them, I think. Perrin had at that point already got 11 A and A stars at GCSE. He'd already got 4 A's at AS level. He was doing brilliantly academically. but that wasn't, you know, what was necessarily at the absolute... Well, it was at the centre of his life, but it wasn't the only thing. When he's from a Hindu family. When I asked him about this big house he was going to have, I should say they'd already moved out from Ilford to Hornchurch to a big house with a swimming pool. So Perrin was obviously seeing the next generation as being something that was going to be even more successful, to take that, you know, an equal step to the steps that his parents had taken, if you like. And I asked him about religion and what that would mean in his life. And he said, well, maybe there'll be a little temple like the one we have at home. He said he goes in there sometimes to pray, and he'd like always to be able to do that. He said, you can take your troubles to gods, and they'll help to bring solace and guidance, but you have to remember them when you're not troubled too. And his friend Vijay, who was there at that point as well, said, God's within yourself. You have to remember God's going to give you peace in the afterlife. My mum says if you can't do anything good for a person, don't do anything at all. And actually, this is one of the things that, you know, really struck me about... Of the seven young people I was following about, I would say four of them were very, you know, they would say that religion was very much at the centre of their lives. Two of those were Hindu, two of them were Christian. And not just that, I mean, I'd be really interested to hear what you all think about this, but they were very, not just religious, but conservative. In many ways, I'd say politically not, well, just not that interested in politics, but probably instinctively conservative with a small c. As I've said, you know, strong family relationships, and a very traditional view of the world, I suppose, you know, which was not, as I say, not very much what I would have... I suppose not what I was expecting. I suppose I expected a little bit more sort of, you know, chafing, you know, rebellion, finding ways to contradict what adults had to say to them, maybe. But that wasn't the way it was. I suppose, I mean, I'm in my 40s, and I grew up in a world where I expected to be rebellious as a teenager. I don't know what people here felt, but, you know, I really felt I had to have some way to kick against the adult world. And I just felt that these young people weren't large. Some of them were doing that. One or two very definitely were. But in the main, they weren't. They were getting on with things. They were working incredibly hard, you know, focusing on their exams, focusing on their futures. And really not at all what you'd expect. So I started looking into this issue of religious attitudes. And because I think, you know, certainly my view as a pretty casual observer of these things was that, you know, what you read in the paper is that church attendance is dropping in this country, certainly sort of Church of England attendance, and that we are becoming a less religious society. And I found that the British Social Attitudes Survey from 2000, which found that 2/3 of 18 to 24-year-olds actually said that they didn't have any religious beliefs, which compared with 1/4 of pensioners who said they didn't have any religious beliefs. So you would think, well, there's a trend there that obviously religion is becoming, you know, maybe dying out. I don't know. And I imagine that a lot of people here have views on that. But I think in areas like Seven Kings, particularly in these areas that I've described, you know, the quite ambitious, hard-working, socially mobile areas, if you like, it's quite a different story. And I actually found some research by a group called the Aston Charities, which are based in Newham. They did some research with Barnardo's in the east, sort of Hackney Tower Hamlets, east of inner London rather than outer London. And they found an absolutely extraordinary picture. The only churches, I'd say, that were really in decline were the sort of Church of England Catholic churches that had been there for a very long time. But they found something like 700 different religious groups in those boroughs. You know, sort of small Christian churches. So I think about 400 of the groups they found were Christian, 300 weren't Christian, an average weekly attendance of 165 people, which seems, you know, pretty healthy to me. And there were sort of African Aladora churches, Seventh-day Adventists, Christadelphians, Moravians, Mormons, Spiritual Baptists, you know, vast, vast range of churches. And of course what's, you know, really happening is that because those areas are the areas where people are coming into the country as newly arrived or relatively recently arrived immigrants, they're bringing their religions with them. And in fact, I think we've got a big influx of people in this country now who've come here because they're going to be, you know, really determined to make something of their lives, and they're going to go on, do very well, and take those values with them into adult life and you know, really into the sort of middle class of this country, certainly the urban middle class. And I thought I would just give you a little bit of a girl called Kessie, who came here at the age of 10 from Ghana. And she's, again, a devout Christian. She likes to spend her spare time at church, particularly singing in the church choir. And I thought I would just read you a little bit of a description of her in church one evening and what she thinks about it. The Elim Church of Pentecost's Fountain Gate Tabernacle stands on Green Lane, Dagenham, between Panoscope Training and Cash Concepts, the shop with options. It's a former cinema, its arch freshly painted and decorated with a dove. Outside, a notice advertises services in English and in the Ghanaian Akan language. Inside, it's clean, neat, painted freshly in welcoming shades of lilac, pale green and pink. In a room at the back, a prayer meeting's already in progress. Kessie's a little late tonight, and prayers have already begun. Afterwards, a boy in a baseball cap and a grey hoodie takes the mic. OK, we'll kick off with Days of Elijah. They arrange themselves on the stage, messily at first. There's no hurry, nothing regimented. They begin to sing, and soon melody fills the huge room. Kessie's dancing now, clapping along with everyone else. The boy in the hoodie's still at the mic, trying to harmonise over them, but it's hard for him to compete. One of the boys at the back's jumping on the spot, one arm in the air, exaggerated, look at me. But no one's really noticing, it's safe here, happy, close and relaxed. Kessie supposes, when she thinks about church, that it's a sort of second family. There's nothing heavy about it, it's just there. People from different backgrounds, all there for one purpose, relaxing, chilling out, getting away from stuff. You can fit thousands into this church if you want to, and sometimes they do. On Easter Sunday, it was packed to the roof. Church is her social life and her fun. Last Sunday, there was a party after the service for someone's birthday. Most of the drinks were soft, though Kessie and her friend Grace have both tasted wine. But when they talk about going out with their friends, they'd never think about going out for a drink. They look at each other when they're asked about this and burst out laughing. Why would they do that? Anyway, they're often at church in the evening. Choir practice goes on till 10 or 11. Sometimes on special occasions, there are all-night services. Kessie says there has to be a balance in your life. If you do too much of anything, she thinks, it'll pull you down. There'll come a point when you snap. There's a time to learn and a time to take a break. And this, her church, is her break time. And so it was really, you know, to her, the important things in life were her schoolwork, her family, and her church. And those, you know, she had very little time, frankly, for anything else. She was doing her A-levels and working incredibly hard. Really, I mean, I have probably never met any young person who worked as hard as she did. She, you know, she really, really had to work hard for what she got. And in the end, she got the A-level results to go to Aston to study pharmacy, which was fantastic. So, you know, she did get the reward in the end, but she really worked for it. And she saw church as, you know, not something she had to do, not a sort of something that was a duty to her family, but the place she went to relax and meet her friends. And perhaps a little bit because, perhaps for you know, a girl with that sort of background, she wouldn't be out, you know, nightclubbing, drinking in pubs or whatever. It would not be her thing, and it wouldn't be, I guess, probably not acceptable to her parents either. And that was a nice, safe place that she could be, where no one would worry about her, and that was great for her. It wasn't always that cosy, I have to say. I mean, this is a school where you've got 80% of the pupils from the Asian subcontinent, or from families, sorry, which came from the Asian subcontinent originally, and probably though that 80% will be fairly evenly split between Muslims and Hindus. And then you've got a sort of 20% who would be Christians, Jews, and, you know, possibly other religions as well. And no religion. So the white, sort of white English, if you like, population of the school would certainly be less than 10%, and I think getting smaller. And I think, you know, that of course that led, I wouldn't say to conflict, I never saw any real conflict, but it led to some chafing, you know, friction, if you like, that was sometimes quite positive. You know, it led to people discussing their beliefs with each other and, you know, thinking about how other people believed and what, you know, the way other people led their lives, and you know, in quite an accepting, and I think perhaps because of the really good atmosphere in the school, that was generally a quite positive thing. And I thought I would read you a little bit from Gemma. Gemma's a great girl. I really, really like Gemma. She's 16 at the time that I met her, or getting on for 16, about to do her GCSEs. And her father was from India and brought up Hindu, and her mother had always been a Christian. And but her family were Baptists, and she's very, very keen on her church. She loves going singing and you know, the church services, and so on. Most of her friends and her extended family she has through her church. But she's also got a very inquiring mind, and she's a person who doesn't accept things easily. She needs to be, you know, she needs to have an explanation. She needs to question things and discuss them and so on. And she would ask the other pupils at school, of course, about their beliefs and about their religions. She said that they talk about it a lot. Her best friend's Jewish, and he teaches at the synagogue on Saturdays. Her other best friend's Christian, but she isn't really religious. She's Church of England. Gemma's dad was brought up Hindu, and some of her friends are Muslims, but she isn't really sure what that means to them. Once they talked about Ramadan and fasting, and she asked them what it meant. They talked about showing devotion to God, giving up everything to him. Then she talked about Lent and about Jesus going out into the desert and the temptations to which he was subjected. She explained that to her, this abstinence was about driving out your demons. It made her wonder, because for her, religion's about knowing why everything is as it is, having something to believe in. The Bible says he sent his son to die for everything she will do wrong in her life. But she wonders if for some people, religion's really about duty and obedience and tradition. And she thinks when she goes away, she'll take all this with her. Wherever she is, wherever she goes, she'll try to create it afresh. The constant company, the bustle, the companionship of her extended church family. And I do think, you know, it was a great place to be, because I think there was a very supportive atmosphere in the school. It wasn't a place where people were at all encouraged to criticise one another or to, you know, to take a rise out of anyone because of their beliefs. And I think that was, you know, maybe sometimes necessary for teachers to say, hang on, no, that's not acceptable. But only sometimes, really. Most of the time, most of the pupils understood that it wasn't acceptable. And they just got on with being together in a really nice way. And, you know, for some of the pupils, there was, you know, there was a kind of a quest there to kind of understand. You know, they weren't all from religious homes. And one of the girls that I was following was a girl called Ruhi, who was 11. And she had come as a four-year-old from Iran as a refugee from Islamic fundamentalism, basically. And she was growing up in a secular household, but she still felt she was a Muslim because she came from a Muslim country. Basically, her family's traditions and rituals, if you like, were Muslim, but she wasn't a practicing Muslim. And it was quite interesting to watch her kind of trying to find out about what she was, but trying to kind of understand religion, trying to understand her Muslim friends, her Christian friends, and spent one afternoon with her in an RE lesson, where the RE teacher had said, right, okay, we're in the library, everyone can go and get a book about whatever religion they want to choose, and find out about that religion and answer some questions about it. So Ruhi decided she was going to get a book about Islam, because she said, it's my religion, but I don't know anything about it. And so she felt it was her religion. And she also felt, interestingly, I think, that sometimes people were, what she said was racist against her because she was Muslim. And I think this was all quite, you know, she's a very bright girl. And I think, you know, there's quite a difficult issue there that she was kind of grappling with in a really quite mature way, I think. And this is just a little description of her in her RE lesson. Ruhi's looking at her book. Okay, so Muhammad was born in Mecca about 570 AD. She holds up her worksheet so that everyone can see she's filled in the top two boxes. I know nothing about my religion, and I've learned one thing. Sometimes she thinks people are racist against her because she's Muslim. But actually, although she is Muslim, she's not really Muslim. No, she is Muslim, but she's not a religious Muslim. The other week, they were looking at newspaper cuttings about Iraq. There was this story. The headline was, I begged my killer for my life. It was about this woman, and she was begging a soldier not to kill her. She said, don't kill me, I'm a Muslim. And the soldier said, you're not a Muslim. He pointed to a terrorist, and he said, that's what a Muslim is. She talked about this with the boy sitting next to her, and they both agreed the soldier was a racist. Her mum says after 9/11, people started thinking all Muslims were terrorists. Sometimes she doesn't like what she hears about religion. Some people's parents teach them if they're bad, on Judgment Day, Allah will save all the good people, and then he'll bring the sun 5 miles from the earth and burn everyone else up. She doesn't want to believe that. The only reason I picked Islam in RE lesson was because it's my religion and I wanted to learn about it, but I don't really believe in it. I don't really believe in religion at all. So that was a girl who was, as I say, you know, going to a school where most of her friends would have been religious and from different religious groups, but who was coming from a home that wasn't religious. And really, as I say, very bright, very intelligent girl who was really, really struggling in her own mind to sort of make decisions about things and trying to work out what she was, I suppose. But So religious or not religious, I think, you know, that one of the things, the other things that struck me very hard about Seven Kings, and Ruhi would be a very good example about of this, would be just the enormous cohort of very clever, very hard-working pupils that there were. And I was talking to Ruhi and her mum one day, and I was saying, well, what do you think you might do when you leave school? And, you know, she's 11. She said, well, I might be a fashion designer. And she said, no, but I'll probably go to university. I mean, she'd already got some of the best SAT results her primary school had ever seen after coming to this country at the age of 4 without being able to speak English. And she sort of looked at her mum, and she said, where would I go to university? And her mum looked at me, and she said, what's the best university in England? So I said, well, I suppose you'd say Oxford or Cambridge. So she looked at Ruhi, and she said, right, OK, you're going to Oxford or Cambridge then. And, you know, you might think that like Perrin and his big house, you might think it's a pipe dream. You know, you might think these are kids who have ambitions they can't fulfil, but I really think that they aren't. You know, these are people who are going to be just amazing in the future. And they are going to be sort of, you know, very much part of the middle class of this country. This is why I think this is important. Not because I think they were average kids. I don't think they were average kids, really. I think they were absolutely amazing kids. Although in some ways average, in some ways absolutely not average. Although I think I'm sure there are a lot of people here would equally dispute the sort of Melanie Phillips view of the world. I think perhaps the world's more complicated than that, and there's different types of people in different places. But I think why this is important is because I think in this country we've kind of come to believe that we're not a very socially mobile country anymore, that perhaps at some stage after the Second World War that it was possible for ordinary, you know, white working class kids to go to grammar schools, get good exam results and go on and become middle class, the sort of Ken Barlow generation. We have that sort of view of people, you know, sort of making good, if you like, and joining the middle classes. And I think we now have the feeling that the sort of white working class have got a bit left behind in this country and perhaps have lost that motivation and drive that perhaps would have been visible in some of these areas 30 or 40 years ago. But I think, I mean, and I don't know, I don't really have any big comment to make about that because it wasn't the kind of area that I've been in, so I don't know whether that's the case or not really. But what I would say that is that if the white working class of this country have lost that sense of the kind of inevitability of progress, that sense that Perrin has and that Ruhi has, that the next generation are going to have more than the last one, they're going to do better than the last one, they're going to be more successful than the last one. If the white working class have lost that, these kids have found it, they really have. And if you look at, you know, what's already happening, the statistics on the proportion of young people in various courses in universities, 35% of all entrants to medical and dentistry degrees in this country now are from ethnic minorities, 38% in computer science, 31% in law. You know, that's really going to make a massive difference to, you know, when you walk into your doctor's surgery, when you go to see a solicitor, when you go to see your pharmacist or whatever. You know, that's going to change, certainly for me, it's going to change my life. And for me, most of those people are white at the moment and don't have their ethnic origins are probably in this country. They don't have all that different kind of huge, rich cultural diversity that certainly the people in Seven Kings have. You know, and personally, I see that as an amazingly positive, wonderful thing, and I hope you do too. But I suppose, just on a more sort of personal note, I suppose I found it all a little bit puzzling some of the time. You know, it's not all going to be nice and easy always. There was one evening I went to talk to Kessie's dad about his views on her educational future, you know, what he wanted for her. And he was incredibly ambitious for her. But every single sort of answer to every question came as a quotation from the Old Testament. And I probably should say at this stage, I'm not religious. I've never had a religion. Wasn't brought up with a religion. And sort of to have somebody sort of quoting, you know, Old Testament stories at me in answer to a sort of journalistic question was, I found that, you know, completely sort of baffling, really. And it took me about 6 months after that. I don't know what I'm going to write about that. How can I write Kessie's dad's answers to my questions about, you know, what sort of future would you like to see her have, as, you know, stories from the Old Testament? How am I going to do that? And it took me a very long time to suddenly think, well, actually, no, it's obvious what the answer to this puzzle in my head is. The answer is, it works for her and it works for him. And it's a strategy that they have to achieve a goal which is very clear and which they've made very clear to me. And it's not for me to question how they get there or whether they get there for that matter, but I'm just here to report that this is what they're doing and this is how they're going to do it. And that's their way of making sense of everything and motivating, I suppose, as well. So, you know, everybody had different ways, and there's a different story I suppose I could tell about Perrin. Very, very different. I suppose it was a sort of lack of politicisation. I said that, you know, when I was younger, I expected to be political. I expected to be, I suppose, radical in a way. You know, expected to sort of question and make a fuss about stuff. Perrin, as I said, used a wheelchair. And he told me about how one day he'd gone to a computer fairy tales court with his friend. And before they'd set off, obviously, they had rung London Transport. And they'd said, would there be a lift at Earl's Court? And the people at London Transport said, yes, there will be a lift at Earl's Court, no problem. So they get there, lift's not working. So, of course, they have to get back on the tube and go to a station miles down the track and, you know, find their way through the streets, which was a real nuisance. And I said to Perrin, well, didn't you, you know, what did you do? Didn't you write to Ken Livingstone? You know, didn't you get angry, complain, do something? He said, oh, no, you know, he said, I expect someone else will have done that. He said it wasn't really his job in life. You know, he was doing his A-levels. He was going to get a good place at university. He wasn't really worrying about whether London Transport's policies for the disabled were up to scratch. Really, it wasn't his role in life to do that. But I suppose the last little extract I wanted to read you was just to say that, you know, the one thing that I think kind of united everybody and united me, if you like, with the school was that just the enormous kind of warmth of the relationships that there were there. You know, this kind of idea of schools as sort of blackboard jungles where the staff hate the pupils and the pupils hate the staff. I mean, I'm sure there are schools like that, but it certainly wasn't the case here. You know, there was this real sense of common purpose that, you know, everybody had somewhere that they knew they were going and they were all working for that together. I'm just going to read you a little description of the last day when the sixth form were leaving to take their A-levels. And the head of sixth form, they were all gathered in the sixth form block, and the head of sixth form was going to address them all, you know, just make a little speech, tell them, you know, wish them luck and so on. The sixth form block's even more packed than usual. Everyone's here. And Miss Jones is trying to contain herself for long enough to address the throng. I'm not going to make a long speech, she says. But every time I say goodbye to one of you, the tears start to come. If I don't do this now, I won't get through it. Already she's looking upset again. You lot have been such a special group of people to me. I'm not the only person who feels like that. We're all going to miss you. We know you're going to go on to achieve greatness. I'm confident that in years to come, some of the people in this room today will be in high positions, in government, in medicine. I hope you'll remember us fondly. The tears are flowing now all round the room. But she ploughs on. I just love you all so much, she says. And amid the cheering and the whistling, someone shouts back, we love you too, miss. And it still makes me fill up every time I read it. I have to say, it was just so lovely. And that was just, you know, that the whole atmosphere at the place was like that. And I would just say, you know, with young people like that in the world running the place, how can it fail to be a better place, really? They were just amazing. Anyway, that's all I've got to say, really. And I'm hoping that some of you will have some questions, so please feel free. And apparently you're going to shout at me and I'm going to sort of repeat them back through the microphone. So, oh, so you want to... Yeah. Hmm. You'll have to shout, I'm afraid. Can you... Did you? Oh, you must... Oh, right. Would you like to come up and use the... I think if you've got something to say, I think it'd be a good idea to so everyone can hear it, because otherwise I'm going to end up trying to repeat it all back and it won't work. So why not? What was the school called when you went there?
Bilmod. When I went to the school, it was called Bilmod. I've been back since, and it's much, much better. When I went to the school, hardly anybody went to university. I think I was only the third. Now many go. When I went to the school, behaviour was much worse than it is now. People got expelled. There was a lot of bullying. So what I think your book does, so I hope I can get it, it smashes the Melanie Phillips myth about teenagers being terrible today. But also, I think the other interesting thing is, one of the reasons it's such a good school now is immigration. It is the achievement, particularly of Asian people. So let's smash another myth. We are not against immigration because it actually improves our schools.
Thank you. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Lady at the back here? If it's just a question, I can probably repeat it back, but...
Do you know what the social background of the parents of
The question was, do I know the social background of the parents and grandparents of these children? Because there is, as you say, an assumption that they're working class, where they may well not be. And I would say it was pretty mixed. Some of them, you would definitely say, were middle class. A lot of them, because not a very large proportion, but a very significant sort of strand in the school was pupils whose parents had come to this country, Asian families who'd come from either Uganda or Kenya. And I didn't know anything about this, and it was interesting because I was talking to Perrin, whose parents were from Uganda, about it, and he didn't know what they were doing in Uganda either. So I sort of looked it up, and from what I can gather, in a very brief sort of history of the migration of those particular people, was that the British colonial service in India invited various people to go and help to run the sort of colonial service, if you like, in Uganda, and that was how those people came to be there. And I guess that means that their ancestors were fairly educated people. I know that Perrin's grandfather, who still lives with him and his parents in this country, isn't literate in English, and doesn't speak English either. So, and that's after 30 years. He would have been a businessman, and I think that would have been the biggest sort of strand, if you like, among all of those people that have been describing, was that most of their families would have been in business in some form. And whether you call that middle class or not, I don't know. Quite a lot of them would have had people in their families, their wider families, who were very well educated. So there was another little girl, Shivani, that I didn't talk about, who had an uncle, I think, who was a professor. So certainly, yes, their wider families would have been. And that's what immigration does, I suppose. It mixes people up to some extent, doesn't it? People arrive in this country. Shivani's dad missed out on a lot of his own education because he had to help run a family business, and obviously a very, very bright guy wants his kids to get a better education than he got. He works in the sorting office at the post office, so I suppose you wouldn't say that was a middle class job. And yet, yes, because of some things in his background, and certainly because of a sort of belief in progress and hard work, he wants his kids to have more than he has. Yes, yeah, I think that's right, and I think you probably would find that maybe different areas, different groups of people who've come to this country from different places in different circumstances might have different attitudes. As I say, Seven Kings is a very particular area. It's a very ambitious, very, as I say, socially mobile area, and that doesn't necessarily mean every area that has a large migrant or second or third generation immigrant population would be the same. I'm sure that I can only really describe what I saw there, but yeah, you're absolutely right. There wouldn't, although you would probably say from looking at the parents' jobs that they were working class, they may well have other factors in their families that would cause education at least to be very highly prized. Yes. Is there anyone else? Well, not a lot, I don't think, really. It wasn't something we talked about very much, funnily enough, because it wasn't something that came up that often. In their world, that wasn't how young people were seen, I suppose. So, I'm sure it must have been discussed sometimes in school. There must have been a PSE lesson or something where they looked at representations of young people in the media. But I have to say, I didn't see one. And generally, I think, they lived in a world where their parents had very high expectations of them. Their parents didn't see them that way, obviously. Their teachers didn't see them that way. And neither did their peers. And those were the things that really mattered to them, And I'm sure they wouldn't have agreed with those descriptions because they would have been completely, completely false, in terms of who they were. But it wasn't a huge, we didn't have, because I suppose, as I said, they weren't very sort of angry, rebellious people generally. So they didn't feel the need to get worked up about stuff. But yeah, I'm sure they would have disagreed with it. Is anyone else? Oh, hello. Of religious education as opposed to religion, I'm not sure that they would have found it all that relevant, to be absolutely frank. I read that little description. The question was, what would be the relevance of religious education to these young people? And I read the description of Ruhi in her RE lesson, and I think it was relevant to her because she had this sort of interest in a religion that she didn't really understand, and that obviously helped her. And they had a great discussion in that lesson between her and her friends. One of them was a Seventh-day Adventist. Another one was, I can't remember, another kind of evangelical Christian. And they were all talking about what they believed in the churches they went to and so on, which was really, I'm sure, you know, helpful and interesting for her, because she was sort of trying to get to grips with it all. But I would have said most of the time, those young people had religion in their homes. And that's where, you know, that's where their religious beliefs came from. And they didn't get that from school. It really, you know, they did RE at school, and that was fine. They might learn about other religions, which I personally would say is important. But I think to most of them, you know, religion was what they did at home with their families. Yeah, I did actually. Yes, sorry, I've been telling you about the good ones, and I shouldn't, because there were a couple. I know I didn't miss them out because I thought they were all bad, because they weren't. They were great, great kids. But no, I did. Sorry, the question was, did I talk to anyone bad who'd been expelled or anything like that? And yes, I did. I actually, obviously, I wanted to be a bit of grit in the book. You know, I wanted the school to not only give me their star pupils, and I don't think they did. They gave me. I asked to follow a boy who had come to Seven Kings after being excluded from another school. And they agreed to that. He was a fantastic lad. He didn't stop taking drugs through the year that I knew him. He continued to do that. But he had a really, really strong mum. And she pushed him through, and he got 11 good GCSEs at the end of it. He was a bright boy, but he wasn't, you know, he wasn't motivated. He was a white working class boy, interestingly. And he got through with the help, a lot of help from his teachers and his mum, but he did very well after having been kicked out of another school. And sadly, there was another boy, a black boy, who I was following, who the school didn't think was a problem at all at the start of the year. They sort of said, well, you know, I was looking for, obviously, for a range of people within the school. They said, well, you know, this boy, Tyrone, lovely boy, a very lively, friendly, funny black boy, aged 13, 14. You know, we don't think we've got a big problem with him at all, but he lacks motivation, perhaps he's a bit too attached to his friends. You know, he'd be an interesting character to follow, but they didn't think he was a big problem. Sadly, halfway through the year, he got into trouble for, well, we had to agree a sort of form of words, intimidating other pupils, and was permanently excluded. And I have to say, it was the saddest thing that I saw in the whole year, you know, because I'd begun to feel for him. He had a lovely relationship with his family. You know, he's absolutely adored his mum, and she adored him. And, you know, she wasn't soft on him by any means. She really wasn't. But, you know, he had really good relationships. He was not some kind of Asbo kid hanging around in the streets with a hoodie. And he didn't look to me like he was heading for a life of crime. Far from it. He wasn't going to sort of probably, you know, become a doctor or something. He was not in the top sets at school or any of those sort of things, but he had a lot of great qualities about him. And I was really saddened when he got excluded from the school. And he was, well, because I was sad because he was sad. He was just destroyed by it, really. He was absolutely flattened, and it was really, really desperate. And I think for everyone, not just for him and his family, but for the school as well. They were as hurt or, you know, as upset about that as anyone else. But yeah, you know, there's certainly, you know, the school isn't a place where everybody is this kind of ambitious, hard-working, you know, go-getting type, but I have to say that the majority are. They were the minority. And I would say probably I ended up with slightly more of the really good kids and slightly more of the really bad kids, as it turned out, you know, and perhaps I could have had a few more in the middle, I don't know. But yeah, that's what it was. Anyone else? Sorry. Oh, hello. Have I ever thought about going to another school? And yeah, I did. I mean, I thought about that when I was starting the book, but in the end I decided that I, you know, just to go to one place and really get under the skin of it was probably better than sort of, and you know, better than sort of going to a whole range of places. I mean, if you go to two schools, are you going to get a representative picture? You know, would you go to 10? Would you go to 100? And in the end, I suppose what I wanted to do was not to create a sort of academic representative study of teenagers as a whole, but just to get a slice of life, if you like. And it was a bit of a, you know, it was a bit of a sort of lucky dip sort of thing, if you like. You know, I just sort of thought, well, okay, we'll see, well, this school's willing to have me, let's see what's there, you know. And yeah, it's not, I wouldn't say these were totally typical teenagers at all. They were just one group of teenagers in one place in this country now. And I do think, you know, they probably had a lot in common with other teenagers as well, but some differences as well. Hi. Because that's, yes, that's quite a big question. I haven't read it. I've read extracts from it. This is, sorry, have I read Peter Hyman's 1 out of 10? Peter Hyman was Downing Street policy advisor, wasn't he? Who then went to work at, I think, Islington Green School. And I think, is he still there? I'm not sure. He was there for quite a long time, working as an assistant head, and he wrote a book about it. So I've read some extracts from it, but I suppose the wider question was, what do I think about Labour's education policies? And I have to say, I mean, I'm very much not New Labour. I'm not a sort of apparatchik of Labour at all. But in terms of what I've seen in schools, certainly as an education correspondent, which I stopped doing just before Labour came to power, and going back to look at the system, 8-9 years after Labour came to power, I thought there was a vast improvement. I mean, that's my honest view. And I think that was the view of quite a lot of people at Seven Kings High School as well. I mean, just in terms of the physical fabric of buildings and so on, which I think is incredibly important. You know, you went into secondary schools in the mid-90s, and they were all kind of scuffed paint, and you could never find your way in because there was no board over the door. It was just sort of find your way and see if somebody will say hello to you. And it was all, you know, there was a feeling of depression, I thought. You know, when I used to go and visit schools, there was a feeling of people being beleaguered. And like I said, I guess some of the people here are probably teachers, I don't know. But I don't know, you know, maybe you've got a view on what, you know, on Labour's policies. But I have to say, I thought the sort of atmosphere at Seven Kings was so much more optimistic, and people were more driven. The teachers were more, you know, there were young teachers coming in there. One of the people I followed, they weren't just kids, I followed some adults as well. And one of the people I followed was a young teacher who was just coming into the profession. And she just so wanted to be a teacher. She loved the job. She was an English teacher and she loved English, but that wasn't the only reason. She did it because she wanted to teach, not because she loved the subject that she was teaching, which she did, but it was more about being a teacher. And the people there were so dedicated, and I didn't hear that kind of, you know, the sort of vibe that you would have heard in the 80s and 90s, I think, a lot. Well, what the blooming heck are we doing being teachers? Can't we get out? You know, why are we so put upon? Why don't we earn more money? You know, I didn't hear that at Seven Kings. And maybe that's because it's an exceptional school. I don't know. But, you know, I have to say from my slim experience in this one school that it was pretty positive. And I'm sure someone's going to come back at me now and say, no, it isn't. Hi. Have I got any future plans? I don't know, actually. I do regular things for Radio 4 for a programme called File on 4. So I'll be doing some more of those. I'll be doing another one of those in the autumn. They're not always about education. I do all sorts of different things. And I don't know. I'm always the same. I've done a couple of books now, and I've always sort of, you know, you get so involved with one thing. And, you know, until that's over, you don't really think about the next thing. And then once it's over, you sort of think, oh, I'm never going to do anything like that again because can't afford it, I've got to earn some money, I've got to, you know, pay the mortgage, do sensible things. And then after about 6 months or a year, I'll start thinking, now, what a project, you know. So I'm sure I will, but I don't know what it's going to be yet. Is there anyone else? The question was how much would I attribute the children's attitudes towards learning to their homes and how much to the school. And I have to say, I think in this particular case, it was not 50-50. I think probably I would still say it came mostly from home, because there were kids in that school who didn't do so well, and you could see that there were differences in their home background, and obviously they had the same school background as the other kids in the school. So I would say, my feeling is it comes very largely from home, actually. This is an exceptionally good school, and, you know, they work really, really hard with the kids who aren't so motivated, you know, and those are the ones they really concentrate on. But yeah, I mean, I think that one of the big advantage that Seven Kings School has is its pupils, you know, and their family backgrounds, definitely. So, anyone else? Oh, sorry, hello, hi.
You do the same sort of thing in Mary, where there's social backgrounds of five, and you've got children which don't have family support. It's like you're talking about there a lot, so you have, like you say, a lot like support at home. Whereas while you interact with all the children in the job, there's a lot of actually coming from private areas.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. I would be really interested. The question was, would I do something like that in an area where the kids did come from really deprived homes, where they didn't have that sort of support at home? And yet I would be really interested, actually. And as I say, when I started out doing this book, that's what I thought I was going to do. And I ended up with two schools, sort of, you know, the sort of shortlist, basically, or two who were interested in doing it. One was a school called Royal Docks, which was in Docklands, which would have been much more that sort of scenario, and the other was Seven Kings. And in the end, Royal Docks decided, after quite a lot of thought, that they just didn't have the time, really, to kind of support me through a year. They had so much to do, and so, you know, they had to, you know, they had such a kind of daily struggle on their hands that they couldn't really cope with having me there all the time as well. So I ended up at Seven Kings slightly by default. And yeah, I would be interested to see what it's like for a school in an area where there isn't, as you say, that kind of family support. Because I think it would be very different, definitely. So, anyone else? Oh, hi. Does a religious background help you to get a better education? I don't know. Yeah. I suppose in one sense it probably does, in that I don't know, but I suspect that in homes where you've got a very strong religious tradition, there's a sort of focus on this is where we're going, this is what we want, this is what we believe in. And I suppose to the extent that those kids probably have a lot of kind of support and backing from their parents, yeah, I would say it probably does. I'm not sure the religion, I don't know, I can't really think why a religion itself would make you do better at school, but I suspect that maybe, you know, having any kind of strong value system that says, okay, you know, we should work hard, we should think about other people, we should think about what we're going to be to sort of make the world a better place, has to motivate you, doesn't it, I suppose. I don't suppose personally I would say it's religion itself, but it's having a value system and having some sort of strong sense of who you are and where you're going, definitely. Sorry, I'm getting my thingy all mixed up here, so I can't walk about so much. Sorry, there you go. Hi. Yeah, this is the question was that would I be interested in doing something on the alternative curriculum, particularly with young people who've been permanently excluded from school and who are not going back into the mainstream system. And I have done I've done a couple of radio programmes already, and I'm really interested in that area, actually. I spent a while last year following a boy who'd been permanently excluded from school, not the one who was in my book, another one, to see what happened to him. And in fact, his story was quite positive because he did get into a centre where he felt really protected and supported and did much better, actually. Pardon? Where? Letchworth. It was a centre that was actually paid for, funded by the schools in the area. So, yeah, I'm really interested in that, and it would be one thing I'd like to do in the future, yeah. So, anyone else? I think we probably need to wrap up fairly soon, don't we? Well, thank you all very much for coming. I'm really grateful to you all for being so supportive and listening so much. Thank you.